For the freak to this colloque today. This is the second time. When I did it afore, I was buying an out of my place, Cried Oxford. And I felt I was even further away from finishing my darg or screaming about McDermott's politics. However, now the Quair is with the publisher, and to coin a phrase, I have returned. Though whether I hae come back mair like General MacArthur, nor irksome reek will no gang into the new. And our praises, as I did the last time, I'll proceed in the language in which I do my scholarship, which is English. And I should explain that I write in a review of the Edinburgh Companion to Hugh MacDermott, and I explained in that I've broken into MacDermott studies through a side window. I am a political historian, not a literary critic. I am, in fact, a comparative historian of Irish and Scottish political history. And that's where this paper is coming from. The conventional wisdom about Hugh MacDermott is that he was a political extremist. We are expected to hang our heads and deplore his fascism or his Stalinism, or is managing to be both at the same time. We might demur and say that despite this he was a great poet, but since he claimed that his poetry was political, this is an unconvincing excuse. Well, I suggest that we simply reject this line of thinking, because like many of the other arguments for Scottish self-abnegation, it conceals an illogicality. Extreme is a relational term, and it only has meaning if we are told to whom or what MacDermott is being compared. In this paper, I'll test the proposition that he was extreme on a specific issue by comparing his language politics with those of his friend, the Honourable Rory Erskine of Mar. But why a politics of language? For an obvious reason, language makes democracy possible. A common language and culture are essential if the mass of the people are going to hold their rulers to account. A 19th century industrialisation required mass literacy, which was brought about by political action. This was always in a particular language, and it brought economic and social benefits for the literate. But democratisation and industrialisation frequently created states within which groups used different languages. This could give rise to political struggles about which language or languages the state would recognise. Often this was a zero-sum context in which only one language could win. Or, like skin colour or religion, language could become a marker of ethnic identity. And European nationalists who were influenced by the Romantic movement with its search for authentic roots often made the revival of an indigenous language a political issue. So in any of these ways, language could give rise to intransigent politics. An example was early 20th century Ireland, where a new movement set out not only to create an independent state, but to restore its ancient language. As Padraig Pearse put it in 1915, speaking at the graveside of the old Fenian O'Donovan Rossa, they had a vision of an Ireland was, quote, not free merely but Gaelic, not Gaelic merely, but free as well. And these ideas influenced a group of Gaelic-speaking Scots in London who called themselves Cumann an Albanach Lonan. In 1910, they issued a manifesto which declared Gaelic. The manifesto was in Gaelic, but they provided an English translation. Gaelic, a national language which enshrines the genius of our people, must be raised again to the position that is its due. It must be reintroduced into our schools and universities, our courts of law, and our chambers of commerce. Language movements have been the heralds of the political salvation of the Hungarians, the Serbs, the Romanians, the Bulgarians, the Greeks, the Norwegians, and many other nationalities. The temperance, industrial, and cooperative movements in Ireland are mainly the result of the new spirit created by the Gaelic League. Well, this passage reflects the influence of the Irish-Ireland movement, which was seeking to restore the Gaelic language as part of a process of making Ireland a self-sufficient independent nation. As I said at the time, burn everything English except her call. The founder of Cumann and Albanach was William Gillies. In 1923, he became vice president of the Scots National League, with Erskine of Mar as president. Erskine was a Highland Catholic aristocrat and a pan-Celtic nationalist whose associations with Ireland went back to the 1890s. He developed a version of Scotland's past which had similarities with those of Irish writers like Father William Ferris, Darrell Figgis, and Eve de Blockham. They were all Catholics who believed that a key feature of the ancient Celtic polity had been a system of government which prefigured papal teachings on subsidiarity. As Erskine put it, there could be no power or authority that was not balanced by some other power or authority erected for the purpose of holding power and authority in check and preventing the abuses to which unbalanced power is apt to give rise. And he argued that the balance had been upset when the Scottish Ardrí, the High King, became an hereditary ruler, and this had created the preconditions for the feudal order introduced by David I. And Erskine believed that Scotland ought to reverse that 800-year-old wrong turning. It should recreate an independent, Gaelic-speaking, federal Scotland with a limited monarchy. And like many advocates of the Irish language, Erskine excoriated W.B. Yeats and the other Anglo-Irish writers for believing that, quote, the beauties of word and phrase, of idea and myth and legend of Gaelic could survive when expressed through English. This was mentally lazy, and such people simply would not take pains to learn Gaelic. He was taking sides in a dispute between two strands of Irish nationalism. One wanted Ireland to be self-governing, but to retain cultural and political links with the British Empire. The other was separatist and militarist, and it usually identified Irishness with Catholicism. So if MacDiarmid was an extremist, we would expect him to have supported Erskine on the Irish language question. In fact, he supported Yeats. When he visited Dublin in 1928, invited by Oliver St. John Gogarty, he saw little evidence of an Irish language revival. He said there was a considerable measure of enthusiasm for the revival of Gaelic prior to the treaty, but the Gaelic encouraging policy of the government has practically killed it off. And this was confirmed in 1949 by Ernest Blythe, director of Dublin's Abbey Theatre. He looked back on the experience of the Irish language movement, and he said, very soon after the black and tan period, a prominent public man said that not more than a dozen individuals out of the scores of thousands who had joined Gaelic League branch classes had learned enough Irish to speak it with reasonable fluency and accuracy. Of course, in mentioning a dozen, he gave too low a figure. If he had said 200, however, I do not think he would have been far wrong. Blythe still hoped that greater government effort and the standardisation of dialects could lead to success and the restoration of Gaelic as the vernacular of the Irish nation. We now know that the restoration of Gaelic by state action proved to be impossible. But MacDiarmid agreed with Yeats that the mind of the Celtic civilization of the past could be conveyed by a literary Hiberno-English which reflected the grammatical structures and characteristic expressions of the original Gaelic tongue. He was not interested in Erskine's programme of replacing one language with another. What he wanted was to extend the range and complexity of language itself as a cultural and psychological medium. This was, as Roderick Watson puts it, a vision of the world of language and also the world as language. And he also argued that the revival of Gaelic in Scotland required a modern socialist revolution, not Erskine's reversion to the Celtic past. He wrote, "It is utter folly to to talk about reviving the Gaelic without appreciating that the Gaelic cannot be restored except by restoring social and economic conditions appropriate to it. It cannot be reintroduced and adapted to the existing system, the whole tendency of which has been responsible for its steady attenuation. He initially opposed the attempts of the vernacular circle of the London Burns Club to revive Lowland Scots. And as many of you will know, in 1921 it commissioned a series of lectures on the Scots language, and MacDiarmid attacked J.M. Bullis' contribution, which suggested that the psychology of the Scots was reflected in the use of the diminutive forms of words. For MacDiarmid, this was infantilism. And the vernacular circle, he wrote, emphasises the part at the expense of the whole and puts the cart before the horse. Had the aim been to encourage all that is finest and best in Scottish literature, whether written in Doric or English, the movement might have merited some support, although, after all, prizes do not produce literature. And he argued that the essence of, quote, the Scottish mentality could be expressed through English. He wrote, Synge, Yeats, and the other great Irish writers found no difficulty in expressing themselves in English, which they yet made distinctively Irish. Is the psychological difference between, say, Oscar Wilde and Joseph Conrad not as profound as the difference between an Englishman and a Scot? Another of the vernacular circle writers was W.E. Craigie, professor of Anglo-Saxon in the University of Oxford and a founder of the Oxford English Dictionary. He was an expert on the Scandinavian languages, who incidentally taught Old Norse to J.R.R. Tolkien. He suggested that Scots could be revived on the model of New Norwegian, Frisian and Faroese. In each of these cases, a language of low status had been revived as a literary medium. None had a standard spelling, and there had been no written form of Faroese. But they had been revived with a standardised grammar and orthography and had been used for a wide range of literature. This was a vision of a language revival that was modern, not a regress to an imagined past. And Alan Bold has described MacDiarmid's experiments using a vocabulary drawn from Sir James Wilson's Lowland Scotch as spoken in the Lower Strathearn district of Perthshire, a book, incidentally, which had an introduction by Craigie. And MacDiarmid now believed that a literature in Scots could lead to the kind of national revival advocated by Erskine, but through the means advocated by Yeats, of reflecting the mentality of Scotland's past that were encoded in the Scots language, but used to express contemporary ideas in a modern way. He did not, however, adopt Craigie's model, which required the expert work of linguists. He preferred to weave the fragmented remains of Lowland Scots into a new synthetic Scots or Lowlands. This was because he believed that the recapture of one part of Scotland's national essence must lead to the recovery of all of it. And he argued in Alban that such a revival was in progress through an alliance of the Scottish Renaissance, the political nationalist movement, the Labour movement, which he thought was taking a nationalist turn, the revival of Crofton agitation, and the influence of Irish immigrants. Since he believed that there was a natural affinity between literature in Lowlands, in Gaelic, and in the Norn of Orkney and Shetland, his programme also implied linguistic plurality. A project of re-establishing Gaelic as a vernacular of Scotland would only have been possible if the Gaels had succeeded in imposing their will on the majority. It was, therefore, incompatible with democracy, and MacDiarmid's influence helped to dissuade Scottish nationalists from going down the blind alley of Erskine's fundamentalism. In describing MacDiarmid as a moderate, I was, of course, being ironic. He would have rejected the label. But the term extreme is even less appropriate. The difference between MacDiarmid and Erskine of Mar was not one of degree, it was one of kind. They operated within completely different intellectual frameworks. Erskine believed that languages were mutually exclusive and immutable, but for McDermid, language, all languages, contained elements that worked at deep levels of the human psyche. A literature in Lalands, he believed, could help to release the nation from the mental carapace that had been restricting it since 1707. Scottish consciousness would be transformed by the development of Lalands as part of the Scottish Renaissance and at the cutting edge of European culture. This has been the significance of our associate and its journal for 40 years. But if we are to remain true to McDermid's vision, we must resist pressure to limit our efforts to popularising the Scots language without also striving to extend the range and complexity of Scottish literature. In my forthcoming book, I've tried to put McDermid's political ideas and polemics into their historical context. I've concluded that he was often unrealistic and wrong-headed, but he was not always mistaken, and he continues to provoke serious thought. I hope we will stop hanging our heads and proudly declare that Hugh McDermid was a great poet and a great Scotsman. Thank you, Peter.